the behavior skills and capabilities you learn in managing a crisis are equally applicable to business as usual, but because they've been learned in a crisis simulation, they are even more deeply embedded than if you'd learn them in a different way. So if you think about the skills and capabilities required in a crisis, there's some of the fundamental ones like running a really focused, effective team meeting, communication, decision-making, situational awareness, prioritization, getting the best out of people. There are just a myriad of skills that you learn in a crisis exercise that are very much applicable to business as usual as well.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today we are joined by Jonathan Hemus, Managing Director and Crisis Management Consultant at Insignia Crisis Management. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, John.
Well, we had a chat last week and I've just been, all week I've really been looking forward to catching back up again with you because it's so many questions, even though we had a really wonderful chat last week. But I just wondered if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself to our listeners and just tell them exactly what it is that you do and specialise in.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I run a business called Insignia. We're a specialist crisis management consultancy, and we work with leaders of businesses around the world effectively to help them do and say the right things on the worst days of their business lives. And that's everyone from Cathay Pacific to Lidl, Stagecoach, DP World. And we work with them to develop crisis management plans, to train their people onto how to deploy those plans, to rehearse teams by running scenario-based exercises, and then, of course, also advising organisations during crisis. And the reason we do that is damage is done to organisations and their stakeholders when they mishandle a crisis. It's not the crisis itself which harms the organisation, it's the response to it which can harm the organisation. So our passion really is giving people the capabilities and confidence to do and say the right things under extreme pressure.
Awesome. And you've got a book out. What is it that prompted you to write your latest book?
Well, I guess it was stimulated by the last thing I said, which is that I hate to see good, successful organizations run by experienced business people mishandle a crisis, do harm to the business's reputation and usually the value of the business, but even more importantly, potentially harm people, whether that is through, you know, injuries or even worse that are caused as a result of a crisis, or the loss of jobs, or investors losing money, or communities losing, you know, valued local employers. So my passion is to end that needless harm and to avoid all of that damage that's caused by a mishandled crisis. And so that was really the stimulus for the book, Crisis Proof. The other reason was that I've been working in this area for 25 years and I am now very much a crisis management specialist, but there aren't lots of people who are working as crisis management specialists. People working within businesses tend to have responsibility for crisis management as an adjunct to their main job. So they might be the head of communications, they might be the head of legal, they might be the head of business continuity or risk, but they're not doing crisis management all of the time. They've got a busy work schedule and they're not trained necessarily in crisis management. So this book is very much designed to target them, to say, you know, you've got this very responsible role within your organization. Here are some of the frameworks, some of the processes, some of the tools, some of the ways of working to enable you to succeed in that role and also to make your business as safe as possible from the prospect of a crisis.
Yeah, I really like the title Crisis Proof, but we know no organization can be
crisis proof, but it's really about, I think from my point of view, what I got out of it is it's really around how do you almost prepare that person so they are crisis proof in themselves for handling a crisis. I know certainly from working in the airline industry, when a crisis happens and you're a leader, it has a tremendous impact on your physiology, your mental well-being, you're tired, you're up all night, it's very stressful, the cortisol. You know, just talk us through some of the things that you train people on and to deal with that level of stress, really.
No, you're 100% right, Rachel. And by the way, you know, the airline industry is a brilliant example of how to do crisis management well. And of course, that's because what they do brings inherent risk, and you couldn't afford not to. You wouldn't be allowed to fly your planes if you didn't do it. But it's a shame that, you know, some other sectors don't adopt a similar approach. But to come back to your question, yes, I call a crisis the acid test of leadership. It is, by its very nature, an extraordinary event. If you're having crises all of the time, then you really have got a problem. So one wouldn't expect to deal with more than a handful of crises during, let's say, a 10-year period. Therefore, when crises do occur, they are extremely visceral, emotional events for leaders to handle. You know, they are, as we've said, unexpected. They are with very high stakes. We've talked about the damage that can be done to reputation and value of a business. They can also be very, you know, damaging to individual reputations. How many CEOs have we seen lose their jobs after a mishandled crisis? And, you know, you are trying to deal with this situation without all of the information that you need, against time pressure, and with massive scrutiny from the media, social media, investors, customers, regulators. So one can really imagine why brains can get scrambled and experienced leaders can do what seem to be irrational things when presented with a crisis. So what we do is to say, let's plan, prepare, train, rehearse beforehand so that when the event happens, you know what to expect and you know how to deal with it. And again, in simple terms, and we can go into this in more detail, but it is about developing a plan which gives you a tried and trusted way of working in a crisis. It doesn't give you all of the answers. It doesn't make the decisions for you, but it gives you a structured, purposeful way of working in a crisis. Training to give people the skills that they need. And by the way, training and coaching to give people the skills that they need. And then for me, the most important part of this jigsaw is the rehearsal, because the plan is the framework, the training gives you the skills, but you only really know if you can deal with a crisis by rehearsing it. So very realistic scenario-based rehearsal, so that when you've done a couple of those, maybe you do an annual exercise, you've done a couple of those, and then bad news, in the third year, a real crisis happens, you fall back on the mental muscle memory that you built through those two previous exercises, and you snap into gear and you respond and shape the crisis in the best possible way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because I'm just thinking about the organizations that I've worked for. Airline, very good rehearsing. It happened, and unfortunately, it happens quite a lot, be it AshCloud or things like that. But when I worked in telco, we were always too busy to rehearse. And yeah, every time a crisis came, we'd muddle through it, yeah, but it was very stressful. And I think we just never had time to rehearse. And I think it's that thing around, what's the trade-off between doing something that you don't think is going to happen and rehearsing for it, but it prevents you from falling over when you are doing it?
Absolutely. And it's one of those many important but never urgent things. Excellent. Until it becomes crushingly urgent because the crisis has already happened. The other thing I'd say is, even if you don't endure it, so let's say you have rehearsed, but you never have a crisis. You might get, you know, a CEO saying, well, we wasted a load of time and money on that rehearsal. That isn't what CEOs say, because in fact, the behaviors, skills and capabilities you learn in managing a crisis are equally applicable to business as usual, but because they've been learned in a crisis simulation, they are even more deeply embedded than if you'd learn them in a different way. So if you think about the skills and capabilities required in a crisis, there's some of the fundamental ones like running a really focused, effective team meeting, communication, decision-making, situational awareness, prioritization, getting the best out of people. There are just a myriad of skills that you learn in a crisis exercise that are very much applicable to business as usual as well. So we are pleased when clients don't have a crisis after having rehearsed. They are also pleased because, for example, thinking of one of our clients in particular, what they've done actually is adopted some of the processes within the crisis management plan to business as usual. And there's a technique we have called the four board system, which is around really making sense of information and getting to decisions and actions quickly. They now use that in their normal meetings, not just during crisis.
Right, brilliant. And I think that's the real difference, isn't it, between you can be a good organisation, but how well you handle a crisis and implement those things can really turn you into a great team and a great organisation.
Well, it is it's a pivotal moment. It will either do that, Rachel, or it'll be the moment that everything you've built is either severely damaged or, worst case, destroyed. What is certain is you won't be the same organisation after the crisis as you were before it.
Jonathan, you say that you've been in this industry now for over 25 years. Where did you first see this? And when you saw what happened, was it a result of companies or an organization reacting in the moment to the crisis and taking action? And if they'd have only been able to put a plan in place at the beginning of it, they probably would have been able to better manage the crisis.
So I guess if I maybe start with what I think was the catalyst for me beginning this career in the first place, which was a good example, and maybe we can, you know, I can talk about some experiences of not so good examples. So I'm going right back to 1989, when I was in my mid-20s, let's say. And I remember being at my parents' home. I hadn't left home at that point, watching the evening news. And suddenly there was breaking news came through, and there'd been an air crash at Kegworth near East Midlands Airport, a British Midland aeroplane.
Yeah.
And I've always been interested in current affairs anyway, so I you know, tuned into it. And what was really interesting was that for the first time, I heard an interview on television with a chief executive via a mobile phone. This is 1989. So Michael Bishop, who was the chief executive of British Midland, took it upon himself as soon as he heard news of the crash to jump in his chauffeur-driven car and to be taken directly from his home to the scene of the incident. He was doing media interviews during that journey, and he just came across so brilliantly, expressing both compassion and care, also the facts about what he knew at that moment in time and what he was going to do about it. You know, an hour later, he was being filmed at the scene of the incident, taking personal responsibility, as, you know, leaders do. And in the days afterwards, you know, he visited all of the victims in hospital. He liaised with their families. He committed to do everything to put the situation right, thorough investigation. The consequence of that was that British Midland sales went up rather than down, despite ultimately it turning out that it was a mistake by the pilot that caused the plane to crash. Now, watching him really inspired me. If you take the converse of that, and sadly, there was another air crash within 6 months of that Kegworth air crash, which was Lockerbie. And that was Pan Am. Now, with Pan Am, the chief executive of Pan Am made a decision not to go to Lockerbie himself, because he felt by him not going, it would distance the airline from the incident. And consequently, their reputation suffered and Pan Am went out of business, not directly or only because of Lockerbie, but it was a very early, very powerful example of two leaders adopting diametrically different approaches to a crisis. I knew which one I liked best. And, you know, these are behaviours that I've seen, both of them, those leaders who rise to the challenge and those that don't, over the last 25 years that I have been working in this area.
In what you've observed from leaders, what is it about a leader that you think, is it a trait, is it a characteristic, or is it rehearsal, training and coaching that distinguishes the two? Because I don't think you're unique in seeing somebody that does it really well and somebody that doesn't do it. They seem to be diametric. It's not that anybody just coasts through a crisis. They either seem to nail the performance even in the worst situations, or you end up thinking, well, they're going to disappear and they'll not have that role in 6 months' time. What is it that sets those leaders apart, do you think?
I think it's both things that you talked about, Rachel. I think it's intrinsic, but I also think training and coaching is important. And if I go to the intrinsic bit, I'm maybe going to use a few cliches now, but I think they're cliches because they're true. In my experience, a successful crisis leader is authentic. They are human and they have deeply held values that they apply and stick to during the crisis. They are self-aware. They also have the ability to see things from other people's perspectives. You know, if I just think about the reverse of that one in particular, the chief executive, and this again is understandable because normally you are, as a chief executive, being judged on the basis of your business's performance, particularly its financial performance. If the chief executive is not able to switch from focusing on my business and our commercial fortunes and switch into understanding and focusing on the impact that your organization has had on its stakeholders and more seeing it from the stakeholder perspective and business perspective, there is a very high risk that you will come across as being, you know, self-serving, overly commercial, overly corporate. And you will recall one of the quotes from the BP Deepwater Horizon crisis about a decade ago when BP's CEO said, I want my life back. And that was a representation of, it appeared that he was more concerned about the crisis on him rather than the impact of the crisis on all those who'd been affected by it in terms of their lives and their livelihood. So that self-awareness, but also quality of empathy is really important. They also have to have the courage and the self-confidence to make early decisions. One of the things I've learned in a crisis is you never have all of the information you would like. And so if you wait until you do, the crisis will have happened 6 months ago and you'll either have been trashed or not trashed, but it'll be too late. And also it is about, as I mentioned earlier, sticking to your values in those decisions. You know, it may be that you don't have all the facts, but those leaders that know in their heart what is the right thing to do will be brave in making those early decisions. So there are definitely some characteristics and traits which are either important or essential for leaders in a crisis. But nevertheless, that training, coaching and rehearsal is very important. I mean, I think it would be hard to train coach and rehearse a leader who simply just didn't get it or didn't have the willingness to maybe behave in a certain way to transform themselves. But even leaders who do have those capabilities benefit from learning those ways of working, from being aware of the traps, and by having a go at deploying those skills through rehearsal. Because again, the more you rehearse something, the more you learn from your mistakes, the more you learn, you know, when things go well. And as John knows, I'm a football fan, and you know, if a football team was going into the World Cup final, the most important day of their professional careers, you'd kind of expect they would have been given a bit of coaching and a bit of training about how best to play this game. So why wouldn't a business get a bit of coaching and training and rehearsal about how best to handle a crisis before they enter the most challenging day of their business career?
I think, Jonathan, you've hit the nail on the head. You keep using the word learning, and the organizations that we would not think of working with are ones that operate under a command and control or in a command and control environment. We like to work with organizations that learn, that mutually learn, that realize that they don't have all the answers, that they, by contributing together, they're going to come up with better solutions. So it would seem that there are going to be some organizations, if they are run by people who have a command and control kind of approach to it, who would never pick up the phone to you, because they know how to deal with it.
Yeah, so
they probably don't.
There's a couple of things I'd like to respond to on that. And if I go down the first track, please remind me about the second one. So I'd like to talk about a crisis-resistant culture and command and control. And I do command and control first of all. You are absolutely right, John. But what I would also say is, in a crisis, if you have a highly collaborative, consultative culture within your organization, and that is your style as a leader, you will absolutely need to learn to adopt a more command and control style of leadership during a crisis. And the trick is to achieve a happy balance between command and control and highly consultative. Because what you really want is, you want a team of people from whom the leader of that team gets the best insights and the best inputs, but those insights and inputs are delivered crisply, clearly, and quickly. They listen to everyone. They pull in insight, even from the quieter members of the team, those who are more introverted, because the loudest person isn't necessarily right. So they quickly take those inputs, but then their job as the leader is to decide and to commit to action and to assign those actions. So absolutely, a dictatorial command and control approach whereby there's no listening, there's no consultation, there's no willingness to listen to someone else's perspective, absolutely is unhelpful in a crisis. But probably, although it's more pleasant, it's equally unhelpful to have an overly consultative approach, simply because you will never get to the point of decisions and actions if you are too consultative in a crisis.
Yes, I can see how that behaviour of being more certain, having gathered all opinion, is useful in that situation. You were going to talk about a second thread.
Yeah, which is, again, plays to your question, John. Creating a crisis-resistant culture is one of the most important things a leader can do in avoiding crisis or making their organisation ready to respond to it. And let me give you some of the characteristics of a crisis-resistant culture. One is the willingness and the humility to accept that bad things could happen to your organization. You know, sometimes leaders and organizations think that they are so successful, so well run, so high quality, that bad things couldn't happen to us. They could happen to our competitors, but not to us. that is a level of overconfidence which is damaging and dangerous, because even the biggest and the best organizations cannot make themselves immune from crisis. The second one, and we kind of briefly touched on it earlier, is a belief that if something bad happens, we will be able to overcome it. Again, I think we've talked about that. That isn't necessarily the case. You know, if you look at Boeing 18 months ago and the enormous trouble they got themselves into, despite being a very, very successful, well-established organization, it shows that sometimes if you do the wrong things, you can't muddle through. Another trait or culture type to avoid is one in which people in power or authority are unassailable, unchallengeable. You actually want an organization, a culture in which people lower down the organization are encouraged to express a contrary view. It is through doing that that you identify some of the flaws, some of the risks, some of the potentially negative things that could turn into a crisis. So being willing to listen to a contrary view, and in particular for a leader to be open and in fact welcoming bad news to be communicated to them. Many's the time when, you know, a little mini incident or issue has been identified by someone at the very front line of the organization, and they either don't know how to escalate that bad news, or they know that it won't be well received. Again, you want a culture whereby communication, early warning of a potential bad situation is to be welcomed. So those are some of the characteristics of a crisis resistant culture. And I guess the final one, and there are others and they're in the book, but the final one would be the leader of the organization championing crisis management. So they are the first one through the door when the exercise has been scheduled, not the one who says, I'm too busy, I can't do this. They are the one who personally, you know, has their signature in the crisis management plan. And setting that example, as we know, in all areas of business, if the leader, you know, walks the talk and exemplifies the behaviours we're looking for, then others will follow suit.
Yeah, I'm just, they're such good examples, and it really does get you thinking. We'd done an earlier podcast around the tyranny of positivity, and I think that really talks to that, that there is a feeling that I do think we're at risk of as a culture of only wanting to celebrate the positives, and you do have to be so careful about that as a leader. So we'll put a nod to that podcast in the show notes, actually. Yeah. I'm just thinking about tips for leaders, because, you know, what springs to mind when you're talking about crisis is a lot of people might be thinking, well, do you know what, most of the crises that make the news and that break headlines are your airlines, your massive chemical companies, your BPs of the world, et cetera, et cetera. And just because they make national headlines, it doesn't mean that a crisis is any less likely for an everyday, any kind of sector company. And I think what we have seen over the last 10, 20 years is none of us are immune from the weather. None of us are immune from COVID-19, or who could have even predicted that last year would happen. But also things like, you know, terrorist activity, it can strike even a restaurant or anybody like that. So is there any examples that you can give us and just perhaps talk to us around somebody that might, a leader that might be a little bit reluctant to engage in this kind of coaching and training? But just to kind of bring it back to crisis can happen to any organisation.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you say, Rachel, and I've kind of led us down this track as well. You know, there is a danger of viewing crises as only being physical events, whether they are plane crashes, terrorist attacks, environmental incidents, even cyber attacks. Actually, the potential scope of crises is even broader than that. Because if we think, let's think about professional services, you know, a crisis is anything which will severely damage your organization. If you are a firm of lawyers, then what is essential to remain in business is retaining the trust and confidence of your clients and to maintain your reputation. So an ethical issue, you know, a partner engaging in completely inappropriate activity of whatever kind, a data breach. I mean, I mentioned cyber incidents. So for a firm of lawyers, it's not going to be, you know, a physical instance is highly unlikely to be the most significant kind of crisis for a firm of lawyers. But there are absolutely crisis types which would be hugely impactful. So I think it is about whatever your organization is doing a reputational risk assessment and identifying what is it that could do us most harm. And it won't be, probably won't be an explosion or a flood or a fire. It may well be something completely different. I mean, we've been working with a care home company during the pandemic. And you can imagine, you know, because we've seen it in the media, the kind of pressure that they're operating under and the media scrutiny. You know, probably 2 years ago, that care home company wouldn't have thought about looking for crisis advice. They very much, you know, valued it over the last year. So I have not yet come across an organization that I believe should not be preparing for crisis. They just need to recognize what their own unique vulnerabilities are. And the reason I mention the risk assessment, I think for a leader to actually sit down with their team and go through that process of identifying what could happen to us, I think that may deliver a moment of realization that we do need to plan for these potential events.
Yeah, I really like that in terms of going through the scenarios, because I'm just thinking across my career now, and it's actually only since I've worked for myself that I've probably not had that many crises. But, you know, I'm just thinking about some of the examples, and I think a lot of the reason why people don't maybe engage in this is the most at-risk crisis thing is personal reputation, somebody in that senior leadership doing something, and nobody wants to admit that or even consider that they would be the person that would do it. And again, the fallout of that. I think the other one that springs to mind, very sadly, it's impacted me twice in my career. Not a crisis that you would think of as making news, but a crisis that would have has a massive impact on the day-to-day operation for a set period of time is when one of your employees dies.
Yes.
And sadly, very young, maybe due to suicide, which was one of the sad cases.
No, and if I can endorse and add to what you've just said, in my experience, there are many organisations which have got a massive area of vulnerability around people-related risks. So they have potentially planned for, you know, an office burning down or a flood or a fire. But what they haven't planned for are those people-related risks. And one of the big reasons is the one that you mentioned, Rachel, that it's quite easy and, you know, it's kind of an objective task to think through, map through, what would we do if our office wasn't available? That's not uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable to think through, what about if our chief financial officer has actually perpetrated a massive fraud and has run off with loads of money? It is uncomfortable to say, what about if a member of our senior leadership team has been engaging in inappropriate sexual activity with a junior member of staff? You know, it is uncomfortable to say, what about if one of our senior leaders says an extremely racist comment or posts something on social media? But these are the very risks which particularly now actually have the power to cause more damage to an organization than a traditional crisis event. Why? Well, because they cut to the very heart of what the organization is about and stands for. And if that is compromised, it is far more damaging than if you are without an office building for 6 months. That can be recovered. So again, it comes back to crisis culture. The most enlightened organizations and the ones that really take this stuff really seriously, are happy or prepared to engage in planning for the worst case, including people risks, not because they believe that their people are bad people or doing wrong things, but because they're open-minded enough to believe that we're not special or unique in the sense that there could be a rogue within our business. It'd be unreasonable to think that there isn't. So they're open-minded enough to go there and prepare for those people-related risks as well as the operational-related risks.
Yeah, just on that, I'm just thinking of a couple of examples that have come to mind. You have to forgive me because I can't remember the names, but KPMG was in the press earlier this year around a comment that their was it MD or CEO in the UK had said about diversity, and also the head of the FA, is it? What is your view on organisations that they take a day or two to think about the issue, and then the predictable fallout is you can almost say to yourself, can't you, that somebody, a head's going to roll within the next couple of days, and that seems to be the fallout. For me, when I kind of see those headlines, you know that's inevitable, but you're also left thinking, well, so what's happened to that culture, or what was happening for that to be the thought process? What is your view on that kind of those kind of scenarios and that kind of outcome?
So couple of thoughts on that. One is that leaders need to be vigilant to a changing external context. And again, this is why a regular reputational risk assessment is really important, because, of course, for example, diversity and inclusion has always been important, but it's right at the top of the agenda now. So you need to be acting in a way which recognises that, both, you know, ahead of the event and in responding to an event which is about diversity and inclusion. So the first thing to say is leaders need to be aware of the context in which they are operating and behave accordingly. The second thing, which is interrelated, is, you know, leaders, and many leaders of, you know, really big organisations are probably in their 40s or 50s. They need to be aware that there is much greater transparency and much greater scrutiny around how they behave and what they say. So sadly, I'm sure a lot more of these kinds of things were said in the past, but they were literally or figuratively behind closed doors. Now those doors are no longer closed. So, you know, meetings are being recorded, images are being posted, you know, words are being replayed on social media or wherever. So again, there's a bit of recognition that you have to expect anything and everything that you say will become public. I also think there is an extent to which we do have to take a step back, and I'm not talking about, you know, either of the specific cases you mentioned, Rachel, but there is also a danger of overreacting to a crisis of this kind. We know there are, you know, social media firestorms, and we know that there are, you know, echo chambers. And one of the things in any crisis, and I think it applies to these kind of situations as well, is that the response, yes, it ideally needs to be fast, but it does also need to be considered. So we need to guard against knee-jerk reactions in any crisis, including these kind of reputational style of crises.
Yeah, I always worry a little bit when the immediate reaction is somebody's got to go, because you think, well, you're not demonstrating that people's behaviour can change and that they can learn from it. Now, obviously, it depends on the severity of the incident. Yeah. I am not talking about those two. But it would be nice if more of that was demonstrators.
Yeah.
When we're facilitating, Jonathan, one of the ground rules that we use is to define what important words mean. And when I'm thinking about the word crisis, clearly it encompasses an awful lot of things that people probably don't attribute to it, to which is what you've covered. I'm thinking that, what's the first step for somebody to sort of approach you and your company in terms of how they should approach this crisis management? Is there work that they should be doing beforehand and considering before they pick up the phone to you? Or is it because everything's in complete context to their industry, to their business, that they should be calling you from the beginning, really?
So I guess the reality is that when people do call us, they will be at different stages of their evolution with regards to crisis management. And I think, you know, if I talk about the, I suppose, the typical process or kind of the overview of what is required to be done, different organisations will kind of come in at different stages. So I think the first stage is to assess what your risk landscape is. That is a helpful starting point to know where the crisis might come from. So an organisation might already have done a risk assessment, or they might not, in which case that might be our starting point. Based on that, and I am kind of simplifying the process, but based on that, probably the next logical thing to do if the organisation doesn't have one is to develop that crisis management plan. That is the way of working in crisis. And it probably would include 5 to 10 risk specific checklists for your organisation. The critical thing, though, is that the crisis management plan must not be just risk specific checklists, because obviously you are then limited if a risk occurs which isn't on your kind of top 10 list. The third thing that they should be doing then is training. So again, some clients may have done a risk assessment, they have a plan, but they want to enhance the skills of their team. That might be where we come in, and that can be everything from training the spokesperson to coaching the leader on decision-making skills to training the administrator who will be required to keep the log of the crisis up to date, which sounds simple but really isn't when you've got a lot of high-powered colleagues who are under extreme stress. Actually making sense out of what they're saying and deciding is quite a skilled job. So that's kind of training for the administrator. Again, maybe they've got that far, but they've never run an exercise. That would be where we come in to say, that's brilliant, you've got that foundation. Now let's give you that experience. And then, of course, the final category of organizations are those that are dialing the metaphorical 999 button saying, help, we haven't done all of that planning, training and exercising. We find ourselves in a little bit of bother. Can you help us, please? And we would always try to do that. It is much harder if the planning and training hasn't happened before. And of course, we can help to make a bad situation not get worse, but you are to a certain extent playing catch up at that point.
Yeah, and I think one of the real benefits I'm hearing, Jonathan, is that we would like that these crises don't actually come to fruition, but there's so many spin-off benefits from actually approaching this subject in terms of behaviours within the organisation. Is there a sort of a process for eking those out for people as well, so that actually this investment is not just about covering a potential crisis, but it is also quite a developmental position for people?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right, John. And I think the first thing to say, though, is that by doing the planning, training and exercising, you actually will make the crisis less likely to happen. Because, for example, by going through an exercise, you will identify flaws, problems, things that need to be addressed. And by addressing them, you make the crisis less likely to happen in the first place. So there is another benefit in doing the planning and training. It does actually make it less likely you will have to deploy those skills. But more broadly, yeah, there definitely are skills and processes, techniques and capabilities which individuals learn through crisis training and exercising which are applicable. As it stands, we've not explicitly packaged them up like that, and maybe that's something that we should think about. But as I say, for example, if you learn how to communicate in a crisis through, let's say, crisis media training, what you are learning to do is how to communicate in an engaging, empathetic, and clear way under extreme pressure to a challenging journalist. That technique, for example, can be used for difficult conversations at work in business as usual. Again, clearly, if you are learning how to make good early decisions in the worst of circumstances where both of your options are in one way or another bad, you know, it's a case of choosing which is the least bad option. The experience of learning techniques and ways of making those decisions under pressure mean that a more slightly less pressurized decision in business as usual becomes that much easier. So there are lots of examples. You have given me stimulus to think about a whole new range of products and services.
Jonathan, question for you. So the first time many leaders may have hit a crisis was 2020. And we're probably not out of it yet. So my first part of the question is going to be, what would be your tips for a leader or a leadership team going through a crisis in terms of resilience, personal self-care, dealing with the stress, you know, not much sleep, et cetera, et cetera. So first point is, what are your tips for dealing with that and surviving that? And then secondly, and I am thinking in response to last year, and I think, you know, whether you like the government or not in place at the minute, I do worry about them with crisis fatigue. What would be your tips then for the aftermath of a crisis? And often it's then like, oh, phew, we're from that. But what's the follow up? What's the check in? What did we learn? Are you OK? Yeah. Have you got the support? And I am thinking to, you know, crises like 9/11, for example, where the aftermath of that, if you survived that, you were in crisis potentially for years of trauma. So two parts to that question, but more on the individual level. What would be your thoughts for that?
So in terms of kind of personal resilience and well-being and tips for that when operating in crisis, I think the first thing is to recognize that that is an issue and it's a really important issue. And I think, and again, there are few good things that have come out of the pandemic, but mental health and well-being of people under pressure in a crisis absolutely is to the fore at the moment. And so I think, you know, the idea of looking after people and, you know, probably the mechanisms that, you know, many, certainly the best organizations have put in place because of the pandemic are equally applicable to another crisis type. So the good news is I think there is greater awareness of the importance of that. I think the one critical thing that I would say to leaders in a crisis, particularly the very best leaders, is you need not only to look after your teams, you need to look after yourself as well. It's very easy for a leader to take too much on their own shoulders in a crisis, to feel that they are expected to be the superhero, to care for their people because they genuinely do, and to forget to care for themselves. Not only is it the right thing morally for them to look after themselves, but if they are the leader, to work effectively over a period of time, to continue to make good decisions, and they will only do that if they look after themselves as well as looking after their teams. And, you know, one of the things that we've always said to crisis management teams, we've worked with leadership teams, we've worked with, is that, you know, you need to pretty much operate on a shift basis. You know, if you've got your, let's call it your A team, you know, working at the beginning of the crisis, they can't work, you know, for maybe it's going to be a week, maybe it's going to be 2 weeks, maybe it's going to be more. So actually, you know, changing shifts at least every day, or rather than the entire team change, kind of moving people in and out of that team, is the only way that you can sustain the effort during a crisis without burning out. And looking after yourself and looking after your teams is a critical part of successful crisis management.
Yeah, and the crisis fatigue bit of the question, and what happens afterwards? What are your thoughts on that?
So I'm going to come at crisis fatigue maybe from a slightly different direction, but then, you know, challenge me again, Rachel, if I've not addressed your question. I think one of the problems of the pandemic in terms of crisis management going forward is that leaders may do one of two things. They may even subconsciously assume that every future crisis will be like the pandemic, and therefore that everything we've learned about managing the pandemic will apply to future crises. Well, that isn't the case. The pandemic is, you know, a massive crisis, but it is genuinely unique. It has affected everybody and every organization around the world at the same time. What that means is there are very few individual organizations under a spotlight. It's all of us in this together. From a communication point of view, there's been very little media attention on individual organizations. Again, that isn't the case in a normal crisis. And of course, it has been hugely long lasting. In a normal, if I can call it that, in a normal crisis, often it is a intense event in which you as an individual organization or person are under that spotlight, and it may be over for good or ill within a week or a month. So one of the things I think leaders need to beware of is assuming that when the next crisis comes along and it's a cyber attack or whatever it is, that everything that they have learned in a crisis in the pandemic can be automatically applied. And the second thing, and it's related, is there's a danger of overconfidence, that we have managed to get through this and we can get through anything. And a final interrelated element, which is we don't need to rehearse anymore because we've been through a rehearsal. Because this was such a unique event, the pandemic is not a rehearsal for dealing with a cyber attack, for example. So that's one take at it. Please, you know, ask me again, Rachel, if I've not addressed your
question. No, that's actually really, really interesting, that point. The only thing I wanted to just pick up on is after a crisis, what would your advice be, and how do you follow up with individuals in that?
So, yes, you are absolutely right. The end of the crisis, when it comes, is a critical moment. And the worst thing the organization can do is to breathe a figurative sigh of relief and get back to business as usual as quickly as possible.
But actually, I'll just throw one other thing in that, is to breathe a sigh of relief, get drunk, and then get back to, and we giggle. But how often does that happen without really addressing the impact on people? So what embellish on that?
Yes, I'm going to talk about the business kind of ramifications, and I'll talk about the personal ramifications as well. From the business side, you have just been through a unique opportunity to learn. We talked about learning earlier on. And it's been a painful experience of learning because you've been through this awful crisis. You must use the opportunity to assess how you responded, what went really well, because these are things that we want to repeat either in the next crisis or maybe, as we've discussed, during business as usual. You know, we've learnt and created wonderful new ways of working. We've learnt individuals on our team have capabilities that we never imagined they had. Let's not lose that. Let's capitalize on it. And in a psychologically safe environment, let's also look at what didn't go so well and what we need to do to address those flaws so that they won't be flaws next time around. So for all of your listeners, if they haven't already done so, I would absolutely do a lessons learned session around the pandemic, because it's been awful. Let's at least get something positive, some value out of it. So please do a lessons learned workshop with what went well, what didn't go so well, and what are we going to do about it? From an individual's point of view, I mean, I think there is kind of a period of decompression after a crisis. It does have, or it certainly can have, a significant toll on individuals. And I think in an ideal world, you know, getting away from the crisis and getting away from work for a period of time when that intense pressure has subsided is a very good idea. I know someone who was involved personally with the Malaysian Airlines incident where the plane went missing, and they were, you know, dealing with relatives, and it had a, you know, a huge impact on them personally, and they just had to take some time out for a number of weeks in order just to be able to, you know, reflect, recharge the batteries, etc. And I think, you know, as part of that, there absolutely is a role for, whether we want to call it, you know, counselling or just conversations with people who understand the kind of toll that a crisis can have, to help people process what's happened and, you know, hopefully to come to terms with it. So personal care, you know, and also support and care from others, I think is really important.
Just picking up on that then, Jonathan, I how do you look after yourself? 25 years managing crisis, or even preparing people to manage crisis. You know, as coaches, we often get a little bit introspective, overthinking and all that. I was just, how do you look after yourself? Because you must be exposed to it all the time.
Yeah. Physician, heal thyself, I think might be the expression. And like many of us, I do my best to follow the mantras and the processes and the advice I give to my clients. But it's actually harder to apply it to oneself than it is to others. Like for many people, my best way of dealing with whatever the stress, anxiety or trauma may be is getting out into the fresh air, exercise, and, you know, simply getting away from the place where kind of all of that stuff happens. So my antidote, as I say, is a good walk, a bike ride, fresh air, natural beauty, and also trying to remember and apply the lessons and the advice I give to clients. I mean, it was very interesting for me during the pandemic, because I was really experiencing it in at least three different ways. I was experiencing it as an individual person, just like everybody else in the world, who was, you know, worrying about their families and the situation for the world. So I was experiencing it as an individual. I was experiencing it as someone who was advising and supporting businesses during crisis. And I was experiencing it as a leader of a business that was affected by it. And again, I use the word learning. It was intensely challenging from all three points of view. But I have learned more in the last 12 months than I have done in the previous 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm a better person in all sorts of ways because of that. So again, I would not have wished it to have happened, but crisis reveals things about yourself and gives you, sounds like the wrong word, but opportunities that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah, I think we definitely echo that. I think whilst this saying can be taken out of context, I have to kind of remind myself that, you know, this crisis, like COVID, isn't happening to me. I've got to change it, that it's going to happen for me, for my future. Yeah. And I think you have to be really, you do have to separate yourself out from this is happening to me, because that can, it can make you feel really powerless.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up and ask you to do the leadership essentials, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you your views on current affairs because I don't think that's fair, but I would like you to share the most inspirational stories of great crisis management that you've come across. What can be the real value in this? Share a couple of your favourite stories. In the worst of times, what has been the best examples of good crisis management?
So I'm going to talk about a guy called Rick Rescorla, first of all, A, because I think he is a phenomenal crisis leader, and also because it just absolutely demonstrates the value of rehearsal and the importance of persisting with it, even when people don't believe that there is a value in doing it and that it's a waste of time. So Rick Rescorla was a Cornish man, but he emigrated to the States. He was a Vietnam veteran, and by the early 1990s, he'd become security manager at Morgan Stanley in New York. And Morgan Stanley was based in one of the Twin Towers. Prior to the 9/11 attacks, a few years before, a truck bomb was placed in the basement of one of the Twin Towers, caused damage and also fatalities. And Rick Rescorla, being a good crisis manager, as we discussed, sat down and analysed the learnings from that truck bomb. And one of his conclusions was that the authorities would probably seal off the danger from another truck bomb, but that the most likely next attack would come from the air. As a consequence of that, he determined that in excess of the kind of fire regulations, the 2,700 members of Morgan Stanley, who were based on 22 floors right at the top of the North Tower, every quarter, unannounced, would have to hear a fire alarm, stand up immediately, stop sending that email, cease that call with that incredibly important client, leave their desks and walk down to the ground and assemble at the muster point. Now, you can imagine that high-powered Morgan Stanley city types based in New York, I won't swear, but got pretty unhappy about having to interrupt their important work, where literally time is money, every 3 months to leave their desks and head downstairs and spend half an hour standing at a cold and windy muster point. Of course, cut forward to 9/11, the alarms went off when the plane hit the tower. All employees of Morgan Stanley immediately knew what to do. They left their emails, they left their phone calls, they stood up, they knew where the stairwell was, they knew how to exit the building, they knew where to get to. And as a consequence of that, of the 2,700 people based at Morgan Stanley, only 11 people lost their lives, which was massively less than many of the other organizations based in similar parts of the North Tower. Sadly, Rick Rescorla himself was one of the 11 who died. I always get a lump in my throat when I tell this story, genuinely. But he was last seen going back up the stairs to try and get the remaining members of staff out. So for me, that is an incredibly powerful example of both the value of rehearsal, because it shows that it does build muscle memory, and it's a wonderful example of leadership as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you can imagine before that happening, those senior executives, the pressure he must have come under, yes, to have even changed that to 6 months, to once a year.
Yeah.
It must just have been an extraordinary, like, belief in what, in the importance of it, that you just can't imagine the barriers he would have come across.
Absolutely.
Number, 11 fatalities, is very sad, but astounding in context.
Yeah. I told the story once at a workshop that we ran, an open workshop, and amazingly, there was a woman in the room who actually worked for Morgan Stanley at the time and knew him and said that was exactly how he was. And he did exactly as you say, have to fight through barriers to get people to do it. But she said he was amazing, and everything, you know, as I've described it, is true. And, you know, she said,
you
I owe my
imagine.
Life to him.
As soon as one person on that board does not get up and leave the building, it gives 20 or 30 others permission not to. And I think that's the power, isn't it, of you have to have the senior leadership team on board because they role model the behaviour you want to see.
100%.
I've got a lump in my throat, got a tear in my eye. It's such a beautiful story. Have you got another one that you'd like to share?
Yeah, so I'm going to come more up to date and... talk about Merlin and Alton Towers. So you will recall that not so many years ago, there was a horrible accident at Alton Towers where teenagers were trapped on the front of the Smiler ride with very serious injuries. The thing that I admire about the about Merlin's response is how they communicated. And also the fact that how they communicated tells me they are the kind of organisation who had done their planning and their preparation in advance for that situation. Why do I infer that? Well, because as soon as the incident happened, and of course I follow these events when they happen because it's of professional importance, the homepage on their website changed almost instantaneously. So all of the cartoons, all of the special offers, all of the music and lights disappeared. And there was just a very straightforward, relatively somber blue screen with a message about what had happened, what they were doing about it, and information for people, you know, if you've got tickets for tomorrow. So that didn't happen through someone making their mind up, this is what we need to do when the event happened. That happened because they had identified this is what we would need to do if we had a serious accident. And we're going to develop the page already. We'll need to populate it with the final few words, but it's ready to go. Second bit of evidence that they prepared beforehand and totally got crisis management and crisis communication was how they used social media. These days, when a particularly, well, any kind of crisis, but particularly a visible crisis occurs, you will all know that it plays out on social media and social media goes mad and everyone's got a view. Merlin and Alton Towers used both Twitter and Facebook very effectively, firstly to communicate the latest information about what had happened, how they felt about it, what they were doing about it. When I started work in this area 25 years ago, best practice was to issue a media statement once a day. You know, Alton Towers were issuing tweets with new information as often as was required. It might be every 8 minutes, every 15, every hour and a half. Whenever anything of significance happened, they updated it. But what they also did was they engaged and interacted with those people who were either concerned or were asking legitimate questions, not trolls, but anybody who wanted to know, you know, my school was due to be going next week. What should I do? I'm worried that my daughter might be at the park. And they responded to all of those legitimate questions, which meant that by the end of the day, the people posting on Twitter were actually posting, we think you've handled this really well. Thank you for caring. It must have been awful for you to have to deal with, which is, you know, a real testament to how they managed that situation. But to finish with the kind of leader element of it, Nick Varney, who was the CEO, and I think still is the CEO of Merlin, he was also brilliant, particularly from a communication point of view. As with Michael Bishop, you know, my first admired business leader, Nick Varney travelled to Alton Towers to be there because he recognised the seriousness of it and he recognised that he, as the leader of the business, needed to be visible given the significance of what had happened. He also began communicating with the media almost immediately, thereby communicating that he cared, both by the fact that he was prepared to do that, but more importantly, by what he said and how he said it. So he communicated clear empathy and concern for what had happened that was clearly heartfelt. He was happy to take on responsibility for what had happened and for putting it right. And he was proactive in communicating the actions that they were taking to address the situation. So for me, that is a really good example of planning, preparation, and then the implementation of a response in exactly the right way.
They are really powerful stories, Jonathan, and I was applying them really to leadership. The first one was, how can somebody influence above in such a large organization, a very powerful, very driven organization with some very sort of powerful leaders? I think that's a real skill. So your guy, Rick, you know, being able to do that is very, very challenging. And the second one was about the importance of visioning. So you actually map out what would this look like if this happened, and what do we do, and how do we communicate it? I mean, to be able to think about the idea that you take off all the smiley faces and all the offers and all the rest of it, and it's just almost seamlessly done, I think goes to reference your point right at the very beginning of this, is that you can't plan for absolutely every event, but what you can do is have all the behaviours in lined up.
I think just to add to that, I think the Merlin example really showed what you spoke about earlier, is that they'd redefined what their stakeholders were. When people think about stakeholders in traditional leadership, the stakeholder is always used as that, the shareholder and the people that pull the strings. The leaders that are getting it right today are understanding that their stakeholder isn't just their shareholder, their employees. It's the people that aren't even customers yet, but that are coming on a school trip in 2 weeks' time. It's the local community. It's the impact on the hospitals. It's the impact on the first responders. It's understanding that a stakeholder today is the wider community.
I think that's absolutely right. And I also think this is one of the other tasks as part of the planning process, that don't wait until the crisis happens to work out who your stakeholders are. And, you know, very specifically, who you would absolutely need to communicate with in the event of a crisis, and how. So let's take an accident scenario. You know, find out ahead of time how you are supposed to communicate with a health and safety executive, and what's the phone number, what's the email address. If we're thinking about a cyber incident, make sure that you know under what circumstances you need to report a data breach, how long you have, it's 72 hours, and specifically, how do you do that? Don't wait until you've been breached to try and start Googling, because you probably won't be able to use your computer anyway because you've been breached. But, you know, if you use your phone, you don't want to be Googling, how do I communicate with the Information Commissioner's officer on the day that you've lost all of your customers' data.
That's been amazing. Thank you so much. I think everybody in leadership needs to read your book. So before we wrap up, would you just like to share your three leadership essentials with our listeners?
Absolutely. So the first one would be true to your values in the crisis, true to your own values, but just as importantly, true to the organization's values. The organizations which suffer the most damage in a crisis are those that act in a way which is contrary to their values.
That's a great one. Yeah. Number two?
The second one would be courageous in making decisions. If you don't make good early decisions, not without considering, but if you don't make good early decisions, the crisis will manage you rather than you managing the crisis.
And finally, number three?
Look after yourself and look after your people.
Yeah, brilliant. I think there's so much value in this conversation, Jonathan. I just want to thank you so much for sharing those stories that give it context, your expertise, and, you know, it's some really wonderful thought starters there for, I think, people to think about this in a much broader context than what we would have traditionally viewed as crisis leadership. So thank you very much. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch, or they actually would like to start thinking about this with you?
So the company website is insigniacrisis.com. I also have personal website, which kind of focuses on things like the book Crisis Proof. That is very simply jonathanhemus.com. You can find me on LinkedIn very easily because Jonathan Hemus is an unusual name. And I also post regularly on Twitter via @jhemusinsignia.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your time. It's been absolutely wonderful having you on.
Thank you.
Really, thank you, Jonathan. Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.